The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen, and we thank them for their support. And last week, we were reading about Samuel Adams, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, along with his cousin, John Adams. Though Samuel Adams did more to advance the revolutionary cause than any other founder, his role in the nation's birth has been largely overlooked, which is just how he would have wanted it. Only amid the pandemonium, the bells changing furiously, did they understand why some had traded buckets for clubs and canes. Soldiers had fired upon citizens. The good citizen who had confronted Preston nursed a scorched sleeve. Blood splattered the waistcoats of bystanders. It stained fingers. It gushed from a massive wound in a victim's head. At least one man gasped for breath on the ground, and another was lifeless. In the street, Hutchinson saw sticks and cutlasses. He would not know until afterward about the club that had been lifted over his head, then quietly snatched away. With difficulty, he was conveyed through back alleys to King Street, where he attempted to shout his way through a conversation with Preston. Had the captain ordered his men to fire on civilians? Hutchinson crossly demanded. Preston replied with equal sharpness. The men had fired of their own accord, though in the commotion, Hutchinson could not make out his words. Later, there would be other difficulties in obtaining explanations. Hutchinson would say that there were so many disparate accounts of the evening that he could not possibly supply a true one with all time in the world. Swept up the stairs to the balcony of the townhouse, the seat of colonial government, he pleaded with the crowd below. He promised a full and impartial inquiry. Nothing further could be done that evening. At length, he prevailed on the throng to retire. Only a small huddle refused, their breaths misting the icy darkness. Hutchinson immediately began to depose witnesses. By 1 a.m., he had arranged for the regiments to return to their barracks. By 2 a.m., he had arrested Preston. The 8 soldiers who had either fired or not fired joined him in prison. By 4 a.m., the town was quiet. Hutchinson knew early on there were 2 casualties. By dawn, there would be another. 5 men were killed and 6 wounded. A 47-year-old black sailor had been shot 2 in the chest. Bullets in his back, a shipmate, had died on the spot. By the time Adams got his hands on events, it had been their misfortune to have faced hooligans with guns loaded and bayonets fixed, trembling with rage and ready to fire upon a multitude in the street. Invisible on March 5, Adams was the center of attention the following morning when Hutchinson convened his council. He summoned as well the commanding officers of the Boston regiments. He wanted as many crown officers in the room as possible. Across town, doctors conducted autopsies and tended to the wounded. At the townhouse, Hutchinson found Boston's select men waiting for him on the doorstep. Would he, they inquired, kindly remove the troops at once? Inside, several council members echoed the request. Hutchinson answered that he was without authority to order an evacuation. From the selectmen, Hutchinson learned that the town, too, had convened an emergency meeting. It appointed a committee, Adams at its head, to call on Hutchinson. As John Adams later drew the picture, his cousin stood late that morning before a sober, bewigged crew in scarlet cloaks and gold-laced hats, commanding life-size images of Charles II and James II peered over their shoulders from ornate gold frames. Hutchinson sat at the head of the table, Colonel William Dalrymple, commander of the land forces, at his side. Before them, Adams delivered what John considered one of the most significant speeches of the age. The gist alone survives. It was a precarious moment. Nothing would restore the town to order but the immediate removal of the troops, declared Adams. Under no circumstances, Hutchinson countered, would he order any evacuation. He regretted the events of the previous evening, but had consulted with the officers of two regiments. They answered to their general in New York. Hutchinson could not countermand him. For his part, Colonel Dalrymple offered to withdraw the 29th Regiment. Ultimately, Hutchinson conceded. The regiment had made itself obnoxious. It could move to the castle, the fort in Boston Harbor, if that would appease the people. He assumed the matter closed. Adams conveyed Hutchinson's reply to the town meeting, which swelled by afternoon to 3,000 people. Packed into the pews of the Old South Church, they deemed the removal of a single regiment insufficient. Late that Tuesday, Adams made his way across Boston for a second time to remind Hutchinson that, by the Massachusetts Charter, the governor, and in his absence the acting governor, assumed command of all military and naval forces within his jurisdiction. Was there to be more carnage in Boston? Adams asked. The troops, Hutchinson repeated, had their commander and their orders. He could not interfere with them. Adams warned Hutchinson of the price of his intransigence. The Massachusetts towns would descend on Boston. 10,000 men would expel the troops if Hutchinson did not. The night ahead would be the most terrible that had ever been seen in America. Hutchinson reminded Adams of the definition of high treason. With a vigorous dash of color, John Adams much later described the scene. His cousin was no orator. On great occasions, however, when his deeper feelings were excited, he erected himself, or rather nature seemed to erect him, without the smallest symptom of affection, into an upright dignity of figure and gesture, and gave a harmony to his voice, which made a strong impression on spectators and auditors, the more lasting for the purity, correctness, and nervous elegance of his style. March 6, 1770, was one such occasion, though the style hardly mattered. Few seemed to share his aptitude or appetite for wearing down an opponent, and no Bostonian more expertly rattled Hutchinson. It was as if decades had prepared Samuel Adams for this afternoon. With a self-recollection, a self-possession, a self-command, a presence of mind that was admired by every man present, he rose. He stretched forth a trembling arm. The town had voted. No redcoat could consider himself safe in Boston, nor could any inhabitant. If you have power to remove one regiment, Adams enjoined Hutchinson, you have power to remove both. 3,000 people awaited his decision. They are become, added Adams, his voice sonorous, very impatient. 1,000 men are already arrived from the neighborhood, and the country is in general motion. It was nearly dusk. An immediate answer was expected. Any bloodshed would be on the hands of Hutchinson, who should consider his life in danger. The language was potent, stronger than Hutchinson cared to repeat, or so much as recall. It made for a spellbinding moment. Adams' ultimatum set every pulse in the room racing. Even Dalrymple reported that Adams made him quake. He seemed more impressed by him than by the acting governor. Adams focused only on Hutchinson, weak as water, as steady as he had ever seen. I observed his knees tremble, Adams later revealed. I thought I saw his face grow pale, and I enjoyed the sight. He had personal reason to savor the moment, but defer to something loftier. Adams thrilled to the display of determined citizens peremptorily demanding the redress of grievances, while Hutchinson seriously doubted that a mob could drive off 600 well-trained regulars. He did not care to approach that Rubicon. He re-canvassed the four Crown officers in the room. They remained of the same mind. Hutchinson alone resisted a concession. It would be difficult to explain to London. He looked to Dalrymple. He preferred an officer make the decision. The previous night had been the worst Hutchinson had known in 59 years, including that on which his home had been pillaged. No one else in the room, he was reminded, believed he could deny the will of the people. Finally, Hutchinson informed Adams that he would demand Dalrymple remove both regiments. Adams' admirers would deem the confrontation pivotal. Hutchinson emphasized its import as well, though for different reasons. Samuel Adams' triumph, he cringed, gave greater assurances than ever that by firmness the great object, exemption from all exterior power, civil or military, would finally be obtained. In his many miserable accounts of the afternoon, he rarely mentioned Adams by name, as if preferring not to put a face on his humiliation. The streets were nearly dark when Adams returned to the Old South meeting house. A hush fell as John Hancock rose to announce his news. The room then erupted, echoing for some time with shouts and applause. The meeting also voted a night watch for the town until the troops had evacuated. For the next weeks, with muskets and cartridge boxes, a group that included John and Sam Adams patrolled the Boston streets until dawn. John Adams deemed his cousin's showdown with Hutchinson worthy of Livy or Thucydides. It struck him as deserving of portraiture. The great painter John Singleton Copley caught some of its flavor when Adams sat for him later. Copley depicted Adams with the intensity on display throughout the duel. He quite literally takes a stand, ramrod straight, militant in his bearing. He is a man fortified by words. With his left index finger, he directs us to the Massachusetts Charter. With his right hand, he clenches the town instructions in a manner that suggests that ideas, too, deliver lethal blows. The result is a battle cry of a painting much copied through the 1770s. Adams defends the charter like Moses with his tablets, Luther with the epistles, as one historian has put it. The picture hinted that an occasional check might intrude, but that, as Hutchinson feared, the progress of liberty would recommence. A week later, troops still stomped about Boston. Adams prodded. 48 hours had been required to land the men. Why was it taking so long to remove them? In the end, an Adams associate accompanied the redcoats to the wharf to protect them, it was explained, from the indignation of the people. By the end of March, Boston was at last free of all redcoats, save for the 9 behind prison bars. Hutchinson's brother-in-law groaned. Thus has an unarmed multitude, in their own opinion, gained a complete victory over 2 regiments of His Majesty's regular troops. Over the next harried weeks, Adams focused not on how he would be portrayed, but on how the events of March 5 would be. There is no better instance of him bracing for and improving upon events. A tragedy had relieved the town of troops, but how would the rest of the province, the other colonies, and the British ministry react? There was much to do in little time for immeasurably high stakes. For starters, the evening of Monday, March 5, needed a name, Adams appears to have been the first to refer to the skirmish as a horrid massacre, a name that stuck. It was imperative as well to dredge from the murk a coherent narrative. Nothing about the 20 chaotic minutes had been clear, least of all to anyone in the thick of them. Soldiers had fired on and killed civilians, but had Preston, a cool-headed popular officer with a reputation for benevolence, ever issued a command? Some distinctly heard him order his men to fire. Others swore he had not. Who had attacked whom? Had snowballs flown through the air, or had those been bricks, clubs, and sticks, or thousands of people, or 50 on hand? Witnesses reported that the first victim carried a stick. Others saw him empty-handed. There was disagreement even on the position of the moon. A sentry had been seen assaulted. Minutes later, three or four men lay dead. What had happened? All agreed the snow was a foot deep, the evening bright. On all other counts, it was cloaked in shadow, an obscurity that Adams rushed to illuminate, both before and after the soldiers stood trial. To his dismay, all but two were exonerated. Did he really mean to suggest that? After four judges and 24 jurors had devoted weeks to the case, they were fools, and he alone could discern the truth. An antagonistic challenged Adams. It seemed he did. Adams would go on to make nearly as much trouble for historians as he did for the British. Biographers have turned him into a neurotic, a socialist, a mobster. One profile consists solely of blistering contempt. Another whitewashes him to the point of anemia. Even when historians acknowledge his influence, he disappears between the lines. Probably no American did more than Samuel Adams to bring on the revolutionary crisis, contended Edmund Morgan. No one took Republican values as seriously as Adams did, writes Gordon Wood. He was the premier leader of the revolutionary movement, an astute politician as ever America has produced. All echo Hutchinson in their claims. The whole continent is ensnared by that Machiavelli of chaos. Hutchinson complained, but the superlatives then slink off, headlines without articles, as if fearing the envy of John, the disapproval of Samuel, or the need to dislodge a man from behind more than 30 pseudonyms. When he does not get enough credit, he gets too much. He single-handedly directed the Stamp Act riots and the Boston Tea Party, in some accounts, the Battle of Lexington, in others. Before his first inaugural address, Thomas Jefferson asked himself, is this exactly in the spirit of the Patriarch of Liberty, Samuel Adams? Would he approve of this? To understand why the new president hoped to channel Adams' spirit is to discover not only where a daring revolutionary came from, but where a revolution did. His curious career explains how the American colonies lurched from spotlessly loyal to stark, staring mad. In 15 dizzying years, how a group of drenched, pipe-smoking Massachusetts farmers 40 miles from Boston and thousands from London might reason that they should act sooner rather than later if they did not care to be finessed out of their liberties. Adams introduced them into the political system, persuading them their liberties were worth the risk of their lives. To lose sight of him is to lose sight of a man who calculated what would be required to upend an empire, and who, radicalizing men, women, and children with boycotts and pickets, street theater, invented traditions, a news service, a bit of character assassination, and any number of innovative extra-legal institutions, led America's history's seminal campaign of civil resistance. Adams banked on the sage deliberation of a band of ambitious farmers, reasoning their way toward rebellion. That was how democracy worked. He dreaded disunity. Neither religion nor liberty can long subsist in the tumult of altercation and amidst the noise and violence of faction, he warned. He refused to believe that prejudice and private interests would ultimately trample knowledge and benevolence. Self-government was, in his view, inseparable from governing the self. It demanded a certain asceticism. He wrote anthem after anthem to the qualities he believed essential to a republic: austerity, integrity, selfless public service, qualities that would become more military than civilian. The contest was never for Adams less than a spiritual struggle. It is impossible with him to determine where piety ended and politics began. The watermark of Puritanism shines through everything he wrote. Faith was there from the start, as was the scrappy, iconoclastic spirit, as were the daring, disruptive excursions beyond the law. Much of the maneuvering Adams kept out of sight while practicing in plain view. He bobs and weaves, vanishing around corners and behind his peers. At times he amounts to little more than a flicker and flash. Even in his letters he seems to have one foot out the door. The clock strikes midnight. He cannot linger. He hates to leave us hanging, or so he says. He will tell us more, he promises, next time. And that wraps up The Noble Fury of Samuel Adams, A Bold New View of the Forgotten Founder by Stacy Schiff. Up next, a short story, All That Jazz, the plucky institution that staged a brassy comeback for America's signature music. An American icon, the Preservation Hall Jazz Band of New Orleans. The seats are simple benches. The space is small. To stand at the back of the hall is to be only 20 or so feet from the band. The wooden walls are washed out. Even the instruments used by the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, founded with the hall in 1961, feel a bit old. It's been a while since clarinets and tubas were central to popular music. And then, of course, there's the traditional repertoire, comprising standards that reach back to the first decades of the 20th century, like Little Liza Jane and St. James Infirmary. Unlike other famous jazz venues that have changed their decor and ethos with the times, Preservation Hall remains the most authentic, with a pure emphasis on the music. In some ways, the antiquity of the scene is the point. It feels like going back in time. The hall, which didn't even have air conditioning until 2019, has persisted against steep odds, much like the city of New Orleans. And at the same time of the hall's founding, New Orleans jazz was in need of preservation. Traditional jazz had enjoyed a resurgence in the 1940s, but just a decade later, rhythm and blues, bebop, and rock and roll were dominating American airwaves and venues, and traditional jazz halls closed around the city. To some degree, those hot new genres of popular music were largely drawn from the traditional jazz that had been born in New Orleans. Joel Dinerstein, a professor of English at Tulane University and author of the 2020 book Jazz, A Quick Immersion, says these new forms of pop were, in fact, different idioms of jazz. Yet despite having proved the roots of this new music, jazz itself was taking a back seat. Recognizing the need to keep traditional jazz alive, New Orleans art dealer Larry Borenstein invited his favorite musicians to rehearse in the garden of his gallery in the French Quarter. A crowd started to form, and over time, people from around the world visited what was then called the New Orleans Society for the Preservation of Traditional Jazz, where they heard the greats of the 20th century, including George Lewis, Punch Miller, Sweet Emma Barrett, and the Humphrey brothers. Around that time, in Philadelphia, a young couple named Alan and Sandra Jaffe were falling in love with jazz. Returning from a honeymoon in Mexico, they stopped in New Orleans in 1961. They decided to stick around. That same year, Bornstein handed his performance space over to the Jaffers, who rented the gallery at 726 St. Peter Street for $400 a month and moved the music inside, and the venue soon became known as Preservation Hall. Alan managed the artists and occasionally picked up his sousaphone and played with the band. Sandra assisted her husband with the books and worked the door. Trained as a journalist, Sandra helped advertise the bands and organized a weekly schedule. Originally, the shows were free, with a request that visitors make a donation. But eventually, the pair started charging a dollar to hear the music. Still, the hall wasn't profitable until at least a decade into their ownership. In 1963, the Jaffs created a touring ensemble to spread the traditional jazz that was enjoying a renaissance in New Orleans. The band's first tour through the Midwest was a success, and by the end of the year, the Preservation Hall Jazz Band was playing to fans around the globe. The group has performed everywhere, from the Fillmore West in San Francisco to Thailand's Royal Palace. New Orleans police cited the Jaffs more than once for providing space for mixed crowds in violation of the city's segregation laws. After Sandra got arrested one day, according to her son Ben, the judge said, "In New Orleans, we don't like to mix our coffee and cream." Ben says Sandra burst out laughing and said, "That's funny. The most popular thing in New Orleans is café au lait." While rejuvenating the city's jazz scene, the Jaffs also materially improved the lives of the artists who performed in their space. "A lot of the musicians were older, and they didn't have any money," Dinerstein says. "Some of them were ill, and they were revived by this. They were great musicians." Alan Jaffe died in 1987. A few years later, Sandra moved to Florida, and Ben took over the family business. But she visited New Orleans often. Each time she stopped at the Preservation Hall before even going to her hotel. And I'm proud to say that I've seen them play several times, twice in New Orleans and some other places too. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I hope you enjoyed today's reading as much as I did doing it.